From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, filling in for Terry Gross. Intimacy is the new film loosely based on the novel by British writer Hanif Qureshi. The film is about a couple, two strangers, who have a weekly silent sexual encounter. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Qureshi about the novel and the film. It's controversial for its unusually graphic depiction of sex. Qureshi also wrote the screenplays for the films My Beautiful Laundrette and Sammy and Rosie Get Laid. Also, we meet Jamaican-born choreographer Garth Fagan. He won a Tony Award for his choreography of The Lion King. And book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews My Wars Are Laid Away in Books, the new biography of poet Emily Dickinson. That's coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Frank Stasio. There's a new threat of terrorism against American targets. Attorney General John Ashcroft tells reporters the FBI issued a warning today asking Americans and law enforcement to be on the highest alert for possible attacks this week. Ashcroft said officials don't know where, when, or what form the attacks might take, but he said it's important to make the information that is known available to the public.
It's important for the American people to understand that these are to be taken seriously, but by taking them seriously on a continuing basis, we can have the good outcome of avoiding very serious additional terrorist problems.
Ashcroft declined to discuss the nature or source of the information that prompted the warning, saying only it was deemed credible. Government officials said today that a Senate office building where anthrax spores were discovered will be fumigated. NPR's Joanne Silberner has this report.
The Environmental Protection Agency has come up with a plan to infuse all 10 million square feet of the Hart Senate office building with chlorine dioxide gas. The Hart building is where a Senate aide opened a letter that contained potentially deadly anthrax spores. The fumigation plans are still undergoing refinement, but the process could begin within a few days. Technicians would first place strips of harmless bacteria around the building to serve as a measure of effectiveness. Then they'd tape off doors and vents. Next, they'd infuse chlorine dioxide gas for a couple of days. The gas loses its effectiveness within minutes, but the building would remain closed while the test strips are checked. If all goes well, senators could be back in the building by November 13th. Joanne Silberner, NPR News, Washington.
More than 1,000 people have been detained or arrested since September 11th as law enforcement officials from local jurisdictions to the FBI continue to investigate the attacks, but very few details have been made public. Today, a coalition of civil libertarian and human rights groups filed a formal request for more information. NPR's Emily Harris reports.
The American Civil Liberties Union and Amnesty International are among those filing the Freedom of Information Act request with the Department of Justice. Greg Nogheim is with the ACLU. He says they're not asking for details of the investigation that would hurt national security.
We're asking for very basic information, and information that has traditionally been open and accessible to the public. Who's being detained? Why? What are the charges against them? Do they have access to attorneys? What are their attorneys' names?
Nogheim says that information is important to make sure investigators are respecting the constitutional rights of detainees. The Department of Justice hasn't said how many people have been released, nor how many still in custody are considered material witnesses to the September 11th investigation. Emily Harris, NPR News, Washington.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 275 points, the Nasdaq down 69. You're listening to NPR News. The commander-in-chief of U.S. Central Command and the head of American forces in Afghanistan arrived in Islamabad, Pakistan today. He reportedly discussed America's bombing operation in Afghanistan with Pakistan's president. Meanwhile, thousands of Christians and some Muslims mourned 16 people killed when masked gunmen opened fire on a church service in Pakistan. Simon Ingram of the BBC prepared this report.
The nuns of Quetta Convent School performed their morning devotions. But beneath a tranquil surface, Pakistan's Christians are gripped by fear. The recent desecration of a Christian cemetery here was a warning signal. In the quiet of their chapel, the nuns of Quetta Convent School can only brace themselves for troubled times ahead. Pakistan's Christians were a predictable outlet for Muslim rage. The longer the bloodshed across the border drags on, the greater the chance that other targets will find themselves in the line of fire.
Simon Ingram of the BBC in Quetta, Pakistan. A teenager who admitted wounding five people in a shooting at a suburban San Diego high school has been found dead. Authorities say 18-year-old Jason Hoffman apparently committed suicide early this morning by hanging himself in his jail cell. Sheriff's deputies say they discovered Hoffman hanging from a vent in his cell shortly before 1 a.m. Last month, the teen admitted six felony counts stemming from the March 22nd shooting at Granite Hills High School in El Cajon. He was to have been sentenced on November 8th. I'm Frank Stacio, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Merrill Lynch, offering customized wealth management services for qualified investors. 1-800-MERRILL or www.askmerrill.ml.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross. The son of an Indian immigrant, British writer Hanif Qureshi has often mined his personal life for his fiction. Qureshi's screenplays for the films My Beautiful Laundrette and Sammy and Rosie Get Laid dealt with a culture clash between immigrant Pakistanis, British punks, and Thatcherites. His novel Buddha of Suburbia explored a father-son relationship in a second-generation immigrant family. That book won Qureshi Britain's Whitbread Prize. His recent novel, Intimacy, takes place over the course of one night, during which a man decides to leave his partner and their twin sons. That was a decision Qureshi himself acted on many years ago. The film adaptation of Intimacy, directed by Patrice Chéreau, begins where the novel ends, with a divorced bartender, Jay, who has a weekly silent sexual encounter with a woman he barely knows. In this scene from the film, Jay, played by Mark Rylance, is being served a drink by his assistant Ian, played by Philippe Calvaro.
How long have you been working here then?
Since my eldest son was born, 6 years ago. Before that, I was a musician, like Billy, sort of.
Funny. I'd never have guessed you had kids.
One day a year ago, I just walked out, went to stay with a friend. Things can happen like that in life, very simple things. A night arrives, which is the last you spend at home, in a house with a wife and family. Next morning, you just open the door and close it again. And if the house is already empty, well, that helped. They'd all left already, so that was a help.
You mean you didn't say anything, you just split?
Say what?
The sex in Intimacy has caused some controversy in Britain. The scenes are numerous and extremely graphic, including simulated intercourse, frontal nudity, and oral sex. I asked Hanif Qureshi what he and director Patrice Chéreau were aiming for.
I think we wanted to make a movie that really was about disillusionment or about failure or about people in the middle age whose lives had somehow come to a standstill or broken down in some way, particularly after divorce, you know. And then what are you left with? You're left with desire. You don't want to be completely isolated. So these couple start to meet and they don't want the complication of a relationship. It's too difficult. So they make love to each other, and through their lovemaking they kind of speak to one another. And each time they meet to make love, the lovemaking is different. It kind of moves the story on to a certain extent. So it wasn't lovemaking, as it were, for the sake of it, but in order to show how a relationship might develop despite the fear of the characters. Relationships develop even when you don't want them to, in a way.
Can you talk a little bit about Jay, who's the main character in the film and in the novel, Intimacy? He seems to be suffering from a kind of desperate loneliness, but at the same time he can't conceive of what would relieve him of his loneliness. It seems to be a crisis of freedom. How do you understand him?
I wanted to write a novel about somebody in the midst of a marriage breakup. Like, it's something that's happened to me, and it's something that's happened to most of the people I know, and I guess it's something that most of us in the future will have to live with in some way, separation, abandonment, and loss. And I wanted to write a falling out of love novel. Most novels, most fiction in the West is a falling in love stuff. And I wanted to write the opposite, about the pain, the violence, the despair, and particularly the guilt you feel when you have to leave someone or when you're left and so on. So I wrote a novel in the form of a self-confession about a man going crazy who has to leave his wife, has to leave his children. And he doesn't really know how or why or what he's doing. He's right in the middle of this despair and this suffering. And the novel really is an exploration of the kind of madness that you feel at these times.
I'm thinking of a quote from your novel, Intimacy. Perhaps I should be impressed by the fact that I haven't attached myself to things, that I'm loose and free enough to walk away in the morning. But what am I free for? Surely the ultimate freedom is to choose, to dispense with freedom for the obligations that tie one to life, to get involved. And the character here is talking about that choice to stay and to commit and everything that involves, to commit to the child, to a relationship, to everything besides, I guess, personal happiness. And it seems to be that this conflict is between duty or moral responsibility and freedom goes to a heart of a lot of your writing and your film work.
I guess so. It's really, though, that it's really about what you do when you realize, when you wake up one day and you realize you're in the wrong relationship, and that happens to a lot of people. And it's about really what's inexplicable in our lives, that how we get involved with people and in situations, and we don't really understand how we got there or what we're doing there or why we're there, what the purpose of this relationship is. This then becomes very dangerous, particularly when there are and painful, particularly when there are children involved. What do you do then? You feel morally obliged to look after the family that you have made and the relationship that you've started. On the other hand, you realise that this could be purely masochistic, that the relationship is a failure, it's going nowhere, it's hopeless, you could both have better lives elsewhere, and so on. I mean, there are real moral issues and real difficulties on both sides here, which is why I wanted to write about it. There are no easy answers to these questions. And as I say, these are things that most of us have to live through or stagger through in some way at some time during our lives. It is a real dilemma. But it's a domestic dilemma, and one that applies to all of us, you know, because we all live in families. And for me as a writer, that's where it really gets dramatic, you know, in the kitchen, in the house, between members of the same family.
I guess someone else might say that's a justification for abdicating responsibility. I'm also thinking of all the flack you must have got from women criticizing this novel and this one character in Intimacies, reservations about monogamy, about marriage, about the whole deal.
I think people mostly leave marriages because they're idealists, because they want better marriages, because they have an idea of what a better marriage is. I don't think people mostly leave marriages in order to then spend the next 30 years being playboys. I think what they want is to have good relationships with other people. And I think people instinctively understand that or have some notion of what a good relationship is, which is why they leave bad relationships in order to make better lives. And I see that as at least as a positive thing.
You were writing from your life in this novel. You left your partner, the mother of your twin sons, just as the character Jay in the novel does. Certainly this caused somewhat of a media brouhaha when you published the book, all of the parallels between your life and this novel. And the issue comes up over and over with writers who draw from their personal lives for the writing, as almost every writer does. And each person seems to have his or her calculus of what's acceptable grist for fiction and what isn't. What's yours?
As you suggest, I think all writers and all artists, actually, painters particularly, you know, if you get married to Picasso, you're going to turn up in one of his pictures. You may be sure of that. I think all artists do that. But I think the more interesting question is that it's really about the guilt that we all feel about what happens to other people in our minds. I mean, writers write this stuff down, but we all, in fact, engage with other people in our own minds in ways that we also feel would be unacceptable to them if they knew what we were thinking. You know, and that's what it's, in a sense, of what it's like to have a real relationship with somebody else, is to be free in your mind to do with them what you like. And I think a lot of this is put onto writers as if writers should feel particularly guilty about what they do with other people's lives. But in fact, it's something that we all do with other people's lives all the time.
I think it's interesting. I know a lot of women took exception to the novel, especially the blatant parallels between your life and the novel. And what surprises me is that if a woman had written this from a woman's point of view, and if a woman had been considering leaving a family and all that entails and the conflicts that it involves, it might have been considered a pretty courageous portrayal of a woman seeking freedom from social norms, forging an identity.
I think the problem with all of these things is that there is no getting away from the fact that nobody wants to be abandoned, that nobody wants separation. You know, my children, still, I drop them off at school and they scream their heads off. They're eight. They don't want to go to school. They don't want to separate from their parents. And we never lose that sense of trauma of being separated and the terror of being abandoned. And I think a book like this will have resonances about that. You know, but of course, our lives are also made up of losses and also the necessity that we all have at certain times to leave other people behind and go on and live other kinds of lives. And I think there's going to be a lot of guilt about that, but it's not something that only men do. And it'd be quite wrong of women to think that it's only men who do that. You know, we all have to do this, and we all have to live through this, and we all have to try and figure out what's going on.
I'm speaking with Hanif Qureshi. He has two new books out in the U.S., Gabriel's Gift and Intimacy. Intimacy has been made into a film. Hanif Qureshi collaborated on the making of the film. It's showing now in theaters. Qureshi was nominated for an Oscar for his screenplay, My Beautiful Laundrette. We'll talk more after a break, Hanif. This is Fresh Air. I'm back with British novelist and screenwriter Hanif Qureshi. His latest film, Intimacy, is an adaptation from his novel of the same name. You grew up in the 60s, the early 70s, in a mixed-race family in the suburbs of London. Your father's Indian, your mother's English, and it was a period in Britain of a lot of racial tension between whites and non-whites. What was your personal experience of that tension?
My father was really the first generation of immigrants to come from India to Britain. And in those days, there were very few immigrants, very few black or brown faces in South London where I grew up. So it was a time of great social change, but also of racism. There were politicians like Enoch Powell who would make political speeches. And at the same time, many of my friends, many of the kids I'd known from school, joined right-wing organizations or became skinheads or became, in other ways, racist, rather like some of the characters in My Beautiful Laundrette, particularly the one played by Daniel Day-Lewis, who was actually based on a friend of mine who became a sort of skinhead and would go out beating up Pakistanis. So these were very difficult times, and the sense of violence and the sense of hatred, the sense of living in a place in which you were completely alienated was very hard on me and on my family as well. And I guess that's why I started to write, in order to try and make sense of what was happening to me, and also to kind of, in the hope that somehow there were other people out there who might understand this. I wrote books because I couldn't speak. I wrote books in order to reach people who were not around me. And I was very influenced at that time, actually, by what was happening in the United States. I really liked writers like Richard Bright, and James Baldwin. I was very impressed by black music, jazz and Hamlet Motown, and also by the Black Panthers, because in a sense in England there was no struggle. There were just a few immigrants rushing around the suburbs trying not to get beaten up. So the civil rights movement in the United States had a big impact on me and my writing, actually.
Your mother's family was what, lower middle class, working class? What was their attitude toward your father and his side of the family?
They were pretty cool about that. I mean, they liked my father and they liked his large family, because in those days there were very few immigrants around. So then the immigrant in those days wasn't the trash they later became. You know, there wasn't the same condescension. And my father actually came from upper-class Indian families and rather grand families. So my English family were rather pleased that my mother was, as it were, marrying up.
Your father wanted to be a writer? Did he write in his spare time?
My father had been a journalist, and then he became a civil servant in the embassy in London. His dream was of being a novelist, but he was a failed novelist. He spent his whole life writing novels which were not published. But he passed the dream on to me. He wanted me to be a novelist. He wanted me to live the life, I guess, that he wasn't able to live himself.
But he did write. He wrote, and you wrote, so you were both there in the house writing at your separate typewriters?
That was a very good way for me and him to be together. Rather bewildering for my mother, who didn't quite understand what this dream was, what we were trying to do. But actually, it was the 60s and it was the 70s, and I, like a lot of kids of my generation, wanted to get out of the suburbs. I wanted to come to London, and I wanted to live a life in culture, as it were, as opposed to working in a bank.
Did your father support that wholly, since he had this dream for you? Or did he balk at, I guess, some of the pop culture, some of the experimental 60s lifestyle you were getting into?
He wanted me to be a writer. He wanted that, and both my parents wanted that. They thought that was a good job to have, a good thing to do. But like all parents, I guess he was pretty shocked by the fact that I was wearing, you know, earrings and velvet trousers and listening to the Pink Floyd. But on the other hand, he was very interested in the 60s, particularly when the Beatles got interested in India, for instance, and Ravi Shankar and Indian culture. My father then became a kind of guru, rather like the character in The Buddha of Suburbia, my novel, you know, and would talk to my friends and to local kids about, you know, what he called the problems of living. So it was odd. On the one hand, he was a sort of despised immigrant. On the other hand, he was a sort of holy guru figure. It was rather odd and quite funny.
Now, you were pretty out as a bisexual in your 20s, at the time that you made My Beautiful Laundrette. What was your reaction to that part of your life on the part of your family?
I think they rather enjoyed hating the rebellion, as it were. I mean, I was a writer, but I wrote movies like My Beautiful Laundrette, which were gay, or novels like The Buddha of Suburbia that were bisexual, and later on a novel like the Black Album, which was about Muslim fundamentalists. I think they felt somehow the novel shouldn't quite be about this kind of things. So I, in a sense, I could have it both ways. I did what they said, and I rebel.
In your films, My Beautiful Laundrette and Sammy and Rosie Get Laid, and a lot of your stories, you've dealt with this clash between immigrant parents with old world values, and they're more materialistic and capitalistic British-born children. And I think it's so interesting that now what we're seeing in many second-generation immigrant Asian families is this young generation that's renouncing the West and turning to Islamic fundamentalism. But at the base of it, they suffer from a lot of they've experienced the same kind of split personality or split identity that you write about and that you yourself have experienced. Could you talk about some of the ways in which you resolved then the split affinities or split alliances, allegiances you had?
Well, I would say from the outset, of course, everybody has a dual identity. Everybody comes from a man, for instance, and everybody comes from a woman. We had to put that together in our minds in some way. We also come from a man and a woman called our parents who are also probably completely different as well. So all children, in a sense, come from dual identities. But an immigrant then has another history, which is his history probably in the third world, which he then has to put together with his future or the possibilities which he sees in the first world. So there's an extra, as it were, dual identity that has to be merged. I guess I did this myself through being a writer, which is a good way of mixing identities, you know. For a writer, the more conflict, the more confusion, the more identities you have within you, the better. But for others, they may want to try and resolve these things politically, for instance, by changing the world. And I think that's when these kind of melanges can become much more inflammable, let's say, politically.
In My Son, the Fanatic, the character that Ampori portrays is a kind of fun-loving, not at all observant Muslim man who emigrates from Pakistan to England. Reading the book, you get the sense that you very much identify with the father as opposed to the son, and that makes sense. You're more of that generation. But it must be an interesting position to be in for you, I think, having gone through the evolution that, that your life has followed, that you're now in this status quo position. You're what a younger generation is rebelling against.
Yes, that's very odd because obviously when I grew up, the parents were straight and the kids were weird. With fundamentalist Islam, it's the parents who are weird and the kids are very, very straight, very puritanical and very strict. And in My Son the Fanatic, I was puzzling about how contrary this seemed to me and how odd this seemed to me. After all, if you live in the West, one of the things about living in the West is that you have a good time. I mean, that's what capitalism and being a consumer can offer you. It's a good time. And I was always surprised by fundamentalist kids giving up the idea of a good time in order for, you know, in order to embrace other values, which seemed to me to be extremely puritanical. And from an era, you know, I'm from the 60s and 70s, so having a good time is what you did. This was a new kind of modern ethic of deprivation, let's say, which was very puzzling.
You know, a profile has been coming out of the terrorist hijackers, the hijackers of the planes that attacked New York and Washington, D.C., and it shows them somewhat as men caught between a secular world of material comfort and hedonism and individual freedom and the West and this fundamentalist world. Now, maybe this is too pop psychology for you, but I'm curious what you think of that profile.
I mean, there are real psychological problems here that we have to talk about. It's not only political. It's really to do, as you do suggest, about being, trying to be in two places at the same time and to hold two different histories inside you at the same time. How do you put them together? One of the things that the West does do to people is strip them of their identity. But, of course, the one thing that you do need in the West is your identity, and everybody proclaims their identity, that, you know, they're black, gay, they're straight, they're this, they're that. How do you find a place in all this? And I guess as a novelist, you can try and pick your way through it and draw a picture of what this is like.
Hanif Qureshi, I want to thank you very much for talking with me today.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Hanif Qureshi is the author of Gabriel's Gift and Intimacy, which has been made into a film. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Dell Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of Going to the Movies, a personal journey through four decades of modern film by Sid Field, author of Screenplay. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we talk with choreographer Garth Fagan about his recent work. Previously, Fagan won a Tony Award for his choreography of The Lion King. And Maureen Corrigan reviews a feisty new biography of poet Emily Dickinson by Alfred Habiger. This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross. That's music from the Garth Fagan Dance Company's performance In Memoriam, The Innocent, The Brave, The Hands, The Minds, a dance dedicated to the victims and survivors of September 11th. It's part of the company's new season, which opens at the Joyce Theater in New York City tomorrow, and features a premiere of Garth Fagan's latest work, Music of the Line, Words in the Shape. Fagan founded the company 31 years ago, and ever since his work has challenged assumptions about gender, race, and political correctness. A native of Jamaica, Fagan incorporates into his choreography African and Caribbean dance, extreme athleticism, hip-hop, and balletic movements, and sets it to widely divergent music, forging collaborations with such composers as Wynton Marsalis and John Cale. Fagan has also worked on Broadway. He won numerous awards, including a Tony and Britain's Laurence Olivier Award for his choreography for the Disney musical The Lion King. When I spoke with Garth Fagan about his piece In Memoriam, I asked him if he had a sense of what consolation people sought in dance.
Not per se, but for me, I was brought up in a family where the arts were always there at times of celebration and at times of sorrow or tragedy. So that's a place I go immediately. I just think that the arts can say so many things because so much is open to interpretation, you know. I mean, in dance at any rate, or even in the visual arts. So much is open to interpretation that you can take your grief, your pain, your ecstasy there and illuminate it, analyze it, or put it in some kind of perspective. And I'm hoping this is what this does. The score for this piece is by Cristobal de Morales, 16th century composer, and it's based on the Book of Job. And as human beings, we all go through Job-like situations from, you know, from birth to the end. And I thought it was very appropriate that that music be used. So it was a universal lamentation.
I was thinking that there are many different directions you could have gone with a memorial dance, more towards grief or poses of grief, and that's not the intent here. This has more of a triumphant feeling. An evocation of bravery. What was your thinking behind that? And how does it reflect your own personal response to September 11th?
Well, I lost an infant child about 25 years ago, and 3-year-old, and that's like awesome grief in a car crash. So I have some idea of what that is. My parents are both deceased, but they lived their lives, you know. And all these people just went to work or were going someplace, you know, not involved in the fracas at all, and then they're gone. But what I wanted to do was to give a glimpse of mankind. You get the work motifs in there. You get the sensual motifs in there with all of the pelvic movement. And you get the prayer motifs, and I was careful not to make it any kind of religious prayer. I just wanted supplication. And then at the end, with the turn-offs, which the Sinead turns off stage, that's where it could be triumphant is the wrong word, but they're freed, you know, from the movements of supplication and the bent, twisted bodies. Then you get these eight people just turning off into the wings. It doesn't leave you down in the dumps. It gives you an idea that as a human being, despite this outrageous tragedy, you can go on. You must go on.
You were born in Jamaica. What was your first dance memory?
My first dance memory was really like party dancing, you know. I come from a family of 13 aunts and uncles on one side and 7 on the other side. So there were always parties. You know, somebody's always having a birthday or a graduation or whatever. And everybody danced, right up to my grandparents, everybody danced. And we didn't have the age-specific parties that are so trendy now. We had parties where you had from children through grandparents, and everyone danced. And but the idea of concert dance or professional dancing never occurred to me. It was just a fun thing that you did. And Ivy Baxter, who was the director of Ivy Baxter Dance Company and who forged Caribbean dance and modern dance into a nice synthesis. She saw me in high school and I had to fill in for someone who had sprained his ankle or something. And I did it on an outrageous deer. And I knew it would upset my father because he was an Oxford graduate, very British gentleman, and Fagans just didn't do things like that.
Someone hurt their ankle, and you, who had no dance experience, said you'd fill in for them?
Well, I was very athletic and was quite the party dancer. You know, had won awards in cha-cha and mambas and what have you.
At dance contests?
Yeah, dance contest. So, I mean, it was a thing to do. And just on a deer, I did it. And all I did was I listened to what this lady told me to do. And totally unbeknownst to me, I went out there and did it. And people said, you were great. And I said, I was what? You know, because it didn't feel great to me. It was, what do I do next? You know, and blah, blah, blah. And she invited me to come to her studio and start taking classes. And she also showed me Martha Graham's A Dancer's World, which is one of the most beautiful films on dance and on art. And Martha, well, you know, what can we say? What an amazing artist and person. And that showed me Mira Hinkson, who became one of my teachers and still my mentor and priestess. And just showed me the possibilities of concert dance. And I also saw men dancing in a very manly way because as a teenager back then, I didn't want to be a swan prince or anything like that. Now that I'm an adult, I understand the value of swan princes. But as a kid, you know, I wanted the more athletic stuff. And she had wonderful dancers.
You founded your first dance troupe, your only dance troupe, Garth Fagan Dance, 30 years ago. Mm-hmm. And back then you picked untrained dancers for the troupe. Why'd you do that? These were people who had no contact with dance. I guess
right,
as you did when you were young.
Right. There were people that I saw at parties who had this really wonderful sense of movement and rhythm. And people on the soccer field or the basketball court, you know. And I wanted to come up with Fagan technique, and I wanted to break the mold. And I didn't want to spend time on training people who had, you know, classical training or major modern dance training. I just wanted to do something new. And I wanted the speed and precision of ballet. The love of weight and the floor of modern dance and the polyrhythms and the use of the torso that you find in African and Caribbean dance. And I wanted to forge that into a new blend.
Garth Fagan is the founder and artistic director of Garth Fagan Dance. Their new season opens tomorrow at the Joyce Theater in New York City and runs through November 11th. We'll continue our conversation after the break. This is Fresh Air. Back with choreographer Garth Fagan. His Garth Fagan Dance performs at the Joyce Theater in New York City, October 30th through November 11th. That will be their new season. Fagan is the founder and artistic director of Garth Fagan Dance, also the Tony Award-winning choreographer of the Disney Broadway musical The Lion King. I think you see a lot of modern dance, and it looks like dancers are trying to look like real people while they're dancing.
Yes.
And it strikes that false note. But watching your company, the dancers look more like real people dancing.
Yes.
Is that a result of the technique or your philosophical infusion to your dancers?
It's a result of the technique and the philosophy, because from day one I didn't want them to do the self-congratulatory thing. You know, a dancer does some fabulous turns and then looks out at the audience for applause. You know, that kind of vulgarity I found boring and tedious. I mean, it is understood that you're professional. People got babysitters, got on the train, and came to see you perform, so now do it. And it was very important to me that you get the sense of people dancing as opposed to hybrid-mannered dancers trying to be people.
I love how the women in your company dance. They are so, so equal to the men. They're just as athletic, just as fast, but they do it without sacrificing the sensuality of their movement or their femininity. Could you talk about creating that? Was that a political decision on your part, that reaction to that girly princess status of the ballerinas?
Yes, yeah. That was a decision that I made. A, to celebrate my daughter. B, because the women that I know and respect are not waiting for any prince to carry them off or tell them what to do. They have a good idea of what they can do and what they ought to be doing. And the whole girl-boy thing annoyed me. These are adults who are dancing. And if the men can turn that fast, well, why can't the women? If the men can leap that way, why can't the women? And by the same token, my women are strong and direct and fabulous. But by the same token, my men also are not just macho, you know, soulless beasts. They have to be vulnerable and open also. But I consciously wanted to do that so that you had this sense of humanity. And then gender and race came down the road, you know, after you'd enjoyed the dancing.
I'd like to talk about your work on The Lion King. You choreographed the Disney Broadway musical, directed by Julie Taymor, and won a Tony Award for your work, and also the Laurence Olivier. Now, in a musical, dance is not the focal point. It's just part of the whole. How do you adapt your choreography to not stand out too much?
Well, you need a seamless whole. You know, you need the evening to be a seamless whole. And there are moments when the music is numero uno. And then there are moments when the dancing is numero uno. And there are moments when the entire parade flows before your eye. And this involves music, costumes, lights, and dancing. And you listen carefully to the director, in this case, Julie Taymor, and hear what her ideas are. And then you go ahead and you forge your own ideas. I had decided and told Julie and everyone that I wanted all types of dance in this musical, because I wanted children who came in to see, you know, modern dance, ballet, hip-hop, African dance, jazz. I wanted them to experience as many of the dance forms as exist, and just kids fooling around, like, you know, I just can't wait to be king. It's just kids fooling around the way kids would do in a bedroom with a pillow fight, you know. For me, the newest thing was the use of Julie's wonderful puppets and elaborate costumes, which in concert dance, I like clothes as minimal as possible, so the human body, which is the dancer's instrument, is seen without much distraction. So I had to use those and use them well, and I had to realize that people were hyenas in this section, and then there were lionesses in the next section, and then there were giraffes. Anyway, it was an amazing experience, and I thoroughly enjoyed it, and it was quite enriching for me.
Did you try and play against people dancing too much like the animal that they're supposed to embody?
Oh, yes. No, it wasn't a stuffed suit show, you know. Julie always wanted the human beings to be seen within the costumes of the animals. So, like, the lioness dance is like a beautiful feminist tome that shows, I mean, all the wonderful range of womanhood. I mean, and, you know, if the lionesses don't hunt, nobody eats, you know. So let's get a grip on that one. And you have all the femininity in the world out there, but still they kill the gazelle so that people can have a meal. And sometimes we're not comfortable with the two perspectives of that being in one person and in one woman. Likewise, the hyenas are horrible, terrible people, but there is some humanity to them. So that was important, that it just wasn't stuffed suits trying to look like an animal. No, it was the way that the lions use their shoulders. I use a lot of that, you know, the essence of being the animal.
So in choreographing hip-hop for The Lion King, where did you learn hip-hop, or what were you drawing on? You're an older gentleman now. I don't imagine you're doing it in
mature,
the clubs.
Mature, Barbara. Not older yet, just mature.
Very good.
Yeah, I go to a lot of parties, you know, so I see it, and my grandkids and the dancers. You know, the dancers, I have company requirements for the dancers to see certain shows, certain galleries, and they have requirements for me, too, you know. And
what does that mean? You have a list of things, that ways in which they should enrich their lives?
Oh, absolutely. When we're on tour in foreign countries, we go to the art galleries. We go and see their national dance or whatever they're most famous for, you know. And it expands the consciousness, and we call those company requirements, and when we have company requirements, you have to go. There's no debate, no whatever, you just go. And they love that, and then they give me company requirements too, you know. I mean, singers are dancers that I wouldn't know of in my general field. They'll tell me.
Garth Fagan, I want to thank you very much for talking with me.
Thank you ever so much, Barbara.
Choreographer Garth Fagan. His company, Garth Fagan Dance, begins a 2-week run tomorrow at the Joyce Theater in New York City. Coming up, a review of a new biography of poet Emily Dickinson. This is Fresh Air. For a recluse who had a morbid fear of the outside world, poet Emily Dickinson has certainly gotten around a lot since her death in 1886. Her life has been the subject of novels, plays, and literary biographies. Another biography of the poet has just been published. Our critic Maureen Corrigan has a review.
The only confirmed daguerreotype image we have of Emily Dickinson shows a young woman, 16 years old, with pale skin, two bands of hair parted smoothly in the middle, and large, round, dark eyes, widely spaced. They're eyes such as a nocturnal animal, like an owl, might have. Eyes made for peering into shadows or holes and discerning small movements. The challenge that Dickinson has always issued to her biographers is that they too should have such eyes, not as penetrating as hers, certainly, but suited to examining dim, small spaces rather than the bright expanse of a public life. Dickinson's latest biographer, Alfred Habiger, has strong night vision. He's also, in terms of the world of letters, a bit of an oddball. His jacket cover biography stresses his interests in butterfly collecting and backpacking over his academic credentials. The feisty, entertaining, and meticulous biography he's written of Dickinson is distinguished from its many predecessors by, first of all, Habiger's no-holds-barred dismissal of most of them. Naming names, Habiger rails against traditional footnote-encrusted biographies of the poet for leeching the life out of their subject, and he groans at recent feminist-inflected biographies for trying to make Dickinson into a sister. Instead, Habiger wants to be on a firmer, factual footing with Dickinson the woman as well as the visionary. He dredges up unpublished correspondence and elegantly rearranges the chronology of Dickinson's poetry to illuminate major spiritual, sexual, and artistic milestones in her life. My Wars Are Laid Away in Books even includes a newly discovered and as yet unauthenticated second daguerreotype of Dickinson. Say it ain't so. This alleged image of an older Dickinson makes her look like my fourth grade nun, Sister Mary Crustacean. Whatever. In a well-known episode, Dickinson once asked a mentor to tell her if her poems breathed. The great accomplishment of Habiger's biography is that his Dickinson not only breathes, she snorts, chortles, and even pants rapturously as she snuggles on an elderly lover's lap. Even if you're not a devotee of her poetry, you probably know the legends and highlights of Dickinson's life. How she grew up in Amherst, Massachusetts, the middle of three children. How in her later years she dressed only in white and became a recluse, insisting that her visitors be received in the parlor while she conversed with them unseen from a stairway landing. How upon her death at age 55, her sister Lavinia discovered some 800 poems, many of them sewn up into delicate little manuscript booklets, crammed in the dresser drawers of her bedroom. And how when, thanks to the efforts of her brother's mistress, those poems were published, Dickinson was posthumously hailed as a fierce American original. Habiger enlarges the familiar story by starting way, way back with Dickinson's 17th century Puritan ancestors. And in a fascinating chapter, he pours over the early anti-female emancipation writings of Dickinson's father, chilling even in the context of their time. Habiger also devotes a lot of original detective work to Dickinson's mother, Emily Norcross, who was so retiring and astoundingly rude when it came to answering letters, most other biographers have tended to overlook her. But according to Habiger, Emily was also her mother's daughter. He traces evidence of what he nicely terms the abrupt unmuffling of an unstandard mind in Emily Norcross's few letters that sound a lot like lines from Dickinson's own cryptic poetry. What else in Habiger's 700-plus page biography is worth mentioning? Fresh evidence for the identity of the mysterious master in Dickinson's erotic poetry. More news about a midlife physical courtship with Judge Otis Phillips Lord, a dispute over the real cause of Dickinson's death, and on nearly every page, inspired citations from Dickinson's poetry to deepen our sense of her daily life. I do have to say that Habegger, to my mind, spectacularly misreads one of Dickinson's most famous poems about marriage, "She Rose to His Requirement." But this is a flaw, not a fatality. Most times, Habegger has the wisdom and humility to let Dickinson's words linger in the ear without literary interpretation. I'll end my review of his terrific new biography by doing the same. Here's a line from one of Dickinson's letters I've never read before. It's a letter about the power of language. "I used to think when I was an ungifted girl that words were cheap and weak. Now I don't know of anything so mighty. Sometimes I write one and look at his outlines till he glows as no sapphire."
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed a new biography of poet Emily Dickinson called My Wars Are Laid Away in Books. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, and Dorothy Farabee, with Megan Howell, Patty Leswing, and Jessica Chu. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, from Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years, and from the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Christoph Eschenbach. He's the chief conductor of the Orchestra of Paris and holds posts in Houston, Chicago, and Hamburg, Germany. In September 2003, he takes over as music director of the Philadelphia Orchestra. On Sunday, he conducted the special memorial ceremony at Ground Zero in New York City. I'm Barbara Bogave. Join us for the next Fresh Air.